Good afternoon. My name is William Pritchie. My bar number is 36498. As always, it's an honor to appear in appellate courts. I would ask for a reminder with about 4 minutes left.
Will do. Thank you.
When I was in law school 39 years ago, I was asked to research a case for the firm that graciously hired me. And I found one that was factually identical, the facts of our case. And one of the older lawyers in the firm said, that will probably never happen to you again. And I don't think it has, and I'm pretty convinced at this point that it never will. When I look at Robert Dieter's criminal practice, he defines inconsistency of verdicts. And it just seems so simple. It's generally understood to mean some logical impossibility or improbability implicit in the jury's findings as to the conviction of a defendant on one or more counts, which is not rationally compatible with those implicit in the findings as to the remaining counts. And in those cases, the jury's verdict of acquittal impeaches its verdict of guilty. And from there, which seems so simple and becomes so complicated when you get into the case law and the history of the subject in Colorado, I found absolutely fascinating. It was really interesting to work on this subject in this brief.
Counsel, I apologize for interrupting,
of course.
Let me try to cut to the chase right at the beginning. We've obviously got an issue here about whether these verdicts are inconsistent. And then we've got another issue, which is, even if they are, what, if anything, can we do about it? And so I guess my question relates to the second. Even if you assume for a minute there is inconsistency here, and I suspect we'll have some argument about that, but even if you assume that, given the fact that we're in an intermediate appellate court, that we have the Supreme Court's most recent ruling in the Fry case, which is binding on us, isn't the argument that you're making something that should be made to the Supreme Court, or probably even to the legislature, and not to us?
It's place the court. That was kind of my comment about on all fours issue, and that is, I read Fry and I go, wow, that presents an issue for me as the appellant in this case. But there's what I think to be a rather significant factual difference here, and that is the jury obviously didn't decide that Mr. DeRemer was guilty and then just opt for the one charge under a theory of lenity. They advised the court, or at least the foreman did, that they quickly found Mr. DeRemer not guilty of criminal mischief and failure to obey an order.
Well, let me ask you about that. I've read that note from the juror, and where does it say anywhere in there what the time sequence is of what the jury found? And second, Mr. DeRemer said he's talking for himself and not the jury. So how do we possibly use that note to discern anything here?
As I read the note, he says, from my perspective during deliberations, there was no question in any of the jurors' minds that he should be found not guilty for failing to obey orders during a riot and for criminal mischief. Most of our deliberations, and they were not that long, were in regard to the charge of active participation in a riot.
I understand that. Where does it say that they reached one verdict first and one verdict second?
They're just saying they quickly dispensed with criminal mischief and failure to obey, and then moved on to discuss the active participation charge. At least that's the way I read it, that they say that in regard, they spent most of their time on that third case.
How do we know that most of that time wasn't first?
I guess that's a fair question that I really can't answer, but it's clearly not a situation in the cases, and I do understand the difficulty in dealing with this issue for the appellate courts or even the trial courts, because That language that you're not sure whose ox got gored. And in this case, I think it's very clear that they didn't decide that Mr. DeRemer was guilty of something and then, okay, they picked this charge. I think that they eliminated criminal mischief and they eliminated failure to obey orders, and at least that's the way I've always understood this letter, is that they then went to that. And I do understand that this court is bound by the orders of the Supreme Court, but I'm looking at the statute, which is 18.1.401, and they're talking about numerous ways in which a jury verdict can be viewed as inconsistent. And Section E is convicting a defendant of an offense that includes an element, not all elements, an element that was identical to an offense for which the same defendant was found not guilty.
Can I ask you about that, Mr. Fritchie? Let me make sure first that I understand your argument. I think your argument is that the acquittal on the criminal mischief meant that the defendant did not damage the property and that this is inconsistent with participating in a riot. That verdict, is that right?
Yes, which also requires damage to property.
Okay, but then now I'm going to ask about the inconsistency. If I'm reading it correctly, criminal mischief requires that your client would have knowingly damaged property himself. The participation in a riot requires that property was damaged, but it doesn't require that your client did it. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding what the inconsistency is.
Because
I mean, let me make sure I'm clear.
Yes,
the jury found your client didn't damage any property himself, but he participated in events that caused others to damage property. That wouldn't be inconsistent, would it?
Well, but what I'm calling on that, Your Honor, is that instruction 14 was, you are further instructed that the above theory of complicity applies to the crimes of criminal mischief and active participation in a riot. So clearly under either case, it could have been the actions of someone else that he's convicted for. And they clearly understood the concept of complicity
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. No, go ahead. I apologize.
I was just stating that when they did find Mr. DeRemer guilty of active participation in a riot, it was under the theory of complicity.
How do we know that?
In the letter, it says, we only barely reached a guilty verdict. It was done so by the judge's rule of complicitor.
That's one juror saying his impression of what happened. There was no special interrogatory. And we have that, the language from the United States Supreme Court case in Powell saying, we're not going to do this on a case-by-case basis. We're not going to get into this kind of speculation about what the jury may have done or what their reasoning was, because it leads us down a path that we don't want to go. So we've got this one guy saying he's begging for mercy for this defendant, and we don't really know what the jury did because there was no special interrogatory.
Well, he says, we only barely reached a guilty verdict. It was done so by the judge's rule of complicitor. So I took that to mean all. And again, what I think sets this case aside and why I think it should, at least to some extent, be on a case-by-case basis is that we're not allowed to ask a jury, how did you get to your verdict under Rule 606? But I've been doing trial work for a long time. I've never seen a letter such as this where they come out and say, this is what we did. And I think that's why this case is factually different and requires a different result. And it will not set any legal precedent for any other case because, I don't believe that it is because.
Doesn't it change the rule announced in Frye? Frye says when you have a conviction on one count and acquittal on another count, that any inconsistency is not grounds for reversal. And the only exception stated by the Supreme Court in Frye is when you have a conspiracy count, and we don't have that here.
Well, because Frye essentially falls back to Dunn and Powell, and it was the federal rule on inconsistency that was based on the assumption that inconsistent verdicts merely reflect the jury's disposition to favor the accused by acting legally in his behalf. And I think we don't have the cases in Frye. And on Frye, a difficult case because, you know, that involved a sexual assault. And of course, it was in that case where the court says, we're going to go this direction, not that direction, because before that, the court was kind of going back and forth and had inconsistent, you know, the Crane decision on one half, and I think it was done. And there were several inconsistent cases that I went through that history in my brief, and I just believe that it's very clear here that even under a theory of complicity, they did not find Mr. Doremer guilty of damaging property, which is an essential element of active participation in a riot, and therefore I think under the facts of this case, it negates
I'm sorry, I want to ask you one quick question on your complicitor theory. What about that theory presented makes the verdicts inconsistent? What about the complicitor instruction makes the verdicts inconsistent?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your honest question.
Well, I understand your argument, that particular instruction is what led to the inconsistent verdicts, and I'm not sure I understand that line of argument.
And I'm still not sure that I understand.
Let me try, and you're past your 4 minute mark, but your argument here is that because it's complicitor, it could have been the same issue where somebody else damaged the property, same as the riot issue. That's,
yes.
That's why. And I guess I have a problem with that argument because even on a complicitor theory for the mischief charge, your client had to have the mens rea to knowingly destroy the property even if he didn't do it. But doesn't that distinguish the crime?
I think the mens rea on both charges is knowingly.
But it's knowingly to do something different, isn't it?
That's something I hadn't thought about. I certainly, and if I had more time, I would take issue with some things stated by the Attorney General in the answer brief on that subject, because the argument that was presented in the brief talks about a grave danger of causing damage, but the instructions 12 and 13 talk about knowingly damage the real property, and on the active participation in the riot, element 4 is knowingly and actively participating in violent conduct that causes damage. Well, it seems to me that it's perhaps, in my mind, a distinction without a difference, and I'd like to reserve a little time.
You may, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. You've got 2 minutes and 18 seconds left.
Thank you.
Ms. Price.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. The verdicts in this case are not inconsistent because the very elements of the crime, of both crimes, are separate and distinct from one another. Under 18.4501 CRS, a person commits the crime of criminal mischief if he knowingly damages the real or personal property of one or more persons in the course of a single criminal episode. By contrast, under 18.8211 CRS, a person confined in any detention facility commits active participation in a riot when he, with two or more other persons, actively participates in violent conduct that creates grave danger of or does cause damage to property and substantially obstructs the performance of institutional functions. By the plain language of these statutes, the elements of criminal mischief and the elements of active participation in a riot are separate and distinct. Under People v. Frye, Colorado law is clear that verdicts are not inconsistent where the offenses involve separate and distinct elements.
Well, we still have the principle that if the jury necessarily made a finding that contradicts that an element exists that precludes a finding in another offense, we could still have inconsistent in that situation and would have to reverse. True?
In that situation, certainly, but that's not the situation that this case presents.
This is the converse.
This is the converse, exactly. Okay. Criminal mischief speaks to when a person, either directly or as an agent under a complicity theory, knowingly damages real or personal property. Active participation in a riot bespeaks the conduct that one engages in. One participates in conduct that leads to destruction of property. these are distinct and separate elements. And the jury may very well have found that Mr. DeRemer did not himself or as a complicitor directly damage that washing machine or directly damage any of the property in the special housing unit. However, his conduct, he admitted to sliding that washing machine across the floor, and the people's exhibits showed that he served perhaps as a lookout in binding the doors of the special housing unit with the telephone cord. That conduct is what justifies the act of participation in a riot. Even if he did not with his own very hands or as an agent under a complicity theory damage that property, he participated in a riot. These are not inconsistent findings. Unless this court has any further questions, the people will stand on our brief and request that this court affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you, Ms. Price.
Thank you.
Mr. Fritchie.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Certainly it's not more than 2 minutes and 18 seconds. When you read the statute, it does refer to great danger of damaging property, but the jury was not instructed that way. There is nothing in the jury instruction, and I didn't prepare these, it was the prosecutor that prepared these, that talked about that caused damage to property, not a grave danger. And I would submit that the court was exactly correct, that when they find him not guilty of criminal mischief, that necessarily negates the causing damage element. And
What court found that?
I'm sorry?
You said the court was correct when it found that.
Oh, I just thought that Judge Gabriel had made a statement, perhaps I misinterpreted it. I think that, and of course the trial court said that, you know, ruled on my motion to for new trial saying that not all the elements are the same. It's only, you know, here I have a situation where one element of one offense has been negated by a finding of not guilty on a different offense that contains the same necessary element, and to me that would be damaging property.
Well, there's no question that the statutes require damage to property. The question is, who did it, and with what mens rea?
And I don't understand, the Attorney General argued that criminal mischief requires that Mr. DeRemer himself damage property, and if that's the case, then why are we having this complicity instruction that criminal mischief could be found guilty of criminal mischief based on the behavior of someone else, not himself personally? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your briefs and your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.